Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds and under 30 cards never to be seen again. I'm Davey, your co-host, and with me as always I got Phil. How are you doing tonight, Phil?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah?
Starting to get a bit of a cold, I think, but all right. I'm going to power through this.
Good thing we record remote, so you can't get any stank on me. Hey, and we also got with us Dean Bills. Dean, thanks for coming on to the show.
Hey, not a problem. Thanks for having me.
We're going to get you some introductions here in just a second, and but in the meantime, we're going to take care of a little housekeeping. As always, we talk about the context. We're recording this show less than a week ago, just about 4 days ago, maybe less. The Warhammer community site let us know that they were going to be rotating out the Season 1 Universals, and understandably, it's big news, and we put the call out to folks to see if they had anything they want to cover, and it was a resounding yes, so that is going to be the topic for tonight. We still don't quite know when Beastgrave is coming out. It's got to be imminent, but it hasn't gone on pre-order yet, but everyone's eagerly anticipating. We're starting to see clues here and there. A lot of people got in touch with us, pinging us on Facebook on the post we put there. You can always get us at WTHCast, and we'll talk some more about that at the end. We want to do some community shout-outs. For me, I was going to say Battle Reports on the YouTube channel for Ready for Action. They've been getting pretty regular on those, and those have been kind of fun. I usually put them on while I'm doing dishes and have something to pass the time. But they're regular enough, and they're clearly done. The guys are playing pretty well, so I'd recommend you go check that out. Give that a subscribe if you haven't done it. And then specific to this one, this episode, Underworlds DB has put in a competitive play filter, which he's going to use so you can toggle out not only banned cards, but then cards that have been cycled out, which is cool. And Phil is always responsive to what the community is looking for. I appreciate that. But in the meantime, normally we do What the Hex is Going On with You. The short of it is that Phil and I were headed down. We got our last chance to win some glass before season two ends. We going down to Cataclysm. Phil, you're still in?
Yep.
Assuming you're healthy? Yeah? All right.
Yeah.
We're taking one more Madison guy. But I'll use the rest of this segment to introduce Dean here. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And then we're going to jump right into it because we got a ton of questions to cover tonight. So, Dean, I first saw you. You were playing in the finals at Adepticon. I sat at the table side and tried to live Discord your game with them on. It was an amazing game. I think Phil and I were pretty exhausted afterwards just from watching it. So that was fun to watch. And then everything I've seen you in, you've been real consistent. I got to play against your team at ATC. I know you were at Nova. Got to the finals there as well. If I'm not mistaken, the boys GT back in 2018, would it have been?
Yep. Yeah, November last year.
Yep. Okay. So give us a little background. I'm sure I've left stuff out, but what brought you to Underworlds, and what were you doing before you were playing Underworlds?
I mean, I've been playing competitive games for just about forever, and most recently in wargaming, I've been playing Malifaux, and I really got into Underworlds just as Malifaux was on a break between second and third edition.
Mm-hmm.
And the game's just, you know, fun, competitive, quick, and that's really all you need in a game, is just those three things, especially for a small size game like this, where just you don't need a lot of stuff, and we're constantly like talking about in our group like how little you need to bring to be able to play the game, which is always nice. You just need to show up with your warband, some cards, and some dice, and that's it, and you're good to go.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I try to make it even less by not even showing up with my warband sometimes. Phil and I definitely had a game where I had a bunch of proxies, because I remember walking in, I was like, this game is so great, I need so little stuff. Sat down, I'm like, I've got boards and cards, but I don't have models, so
right.
Yeah, Phil humored me with some really atrocious substitutes for some chain rash, but he's a good sport. So
as far as like results have been, I've played in four Grand Clash or team Grand Clashes or whatever total, and it's been first or second every time. So as far as consistency goes, that's pretty good. It's
not the worst. No, it's right up there. What is the next one on your agenda here?
I'm thinking it'll probably be Du Bois again in November, be the next one I travel to. Okay. Once I travel, for me, it's local. It's like 5 minutes away, so I'm definitely going to go. It's not a Grand Clash this year, but I'll still make an appearance and just see how that goes. Just play some Beastgrave.
Yeah.
And after that, Adepticon and Nova are really the only ones that are planned for next year.
Fair enough. And you theoretically should be going to Nova as part of the Grand Championship, right? Grand Master Championship that they're holding. So.
Yep. They've said we're invited, so... I'm going to be there anyway. Might as well play.
Yeah, sounds cool. I'm going to see if I can get some work done and see if I can make it out there. If nothing else, it'd be cool to just see. I'm sure they'll have a side event for those of us who are not champions. But
yeah, I think I heard that they were running a Grand Clash in addition to the championship.
Perfect. I know there's some other competitive events like Privateer Press would always do a last chance qualifier to get in. Man, I can't imagine playing in a Grand Clash coming out of that and going into the lion's den of the Grandmaster. Like, I would just need to go in like a sensory deprivation tank afterwards or something like that. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been toying with the idea of getting out to LVO, but... We'll see how that shakes out. So, or the SoCal Open, I don't know. They're all pipe dreams until they happen, but we'll see how it goes. So at the very least, we'll see at Adepticon, I think.
Cool.
Definitely. Las Vegas and SoCal are just a very long way away.
Sure.
Yeah. I try to limit my travels to, 10 hours driving.
Yeah.
That's about it.
I just took the family on a trip here where at either end we had about a 30-hour travel thing, but we're trying to take the train, and it was not the classic romantic train ride that you might imagine. So think a slightly bigger public bus, and then you might have it. So anyway, that's enough about that. Hey, you guys, anything you want to touch out, community shout-outs or anything, or we jump right into this? Rotation, our main topic for the evening.
Let's get into it.
All right, let's do it. So what we're going to talk about what we know, just to make sure if there's anybody who missed the post, and we're going to jump right into the listener questions. And there were so many questions that came in, I kind of grouped them into two categories that would kind of cover some of the things we might want to talk about. Of course, if we may diverge or hop off on our own tangents as we go, we'll just see where that goes. But we'll be getting into questions about specific cards, impact on the meta, what it means for the community, and then some other kind of grab all things. But start out, hey, Phil, can you lay down what it is we actually know right at this point about the rotation?
So what we know right now is that the plan going forward is that for every new season, the two seasons back from that, so currently that would be Shadespire when Beastgrave drops, all of the universal cards from that season will then be cycled out of the game. And that way, going forward, you have a constant cycling system to move cards in and out as we move into each season. So there will only ever be two seasons of universal cards available to play with at any given time. Mm-hmm. I guess it's not spelled out exactly, but this... From the picture that they post, it looks like this includes all of the like supplemental card sets that were released at the tail end of each release. So that would be a Leaders Pack for Season 1 and Echoes of Glory for Season 2. The little card box is obviously blank for Beastgrave. We don't know what that's going to be yet, but it looks like that's going to continue to be a pattern.
Okay. And then do we know anything about... We think it's happening right when the box itself drops, like the core set. Is that our pivot point?
That was my interpretation of it.
Mine as well.
I could be wrong on that.
I can't personally imagine that they would leave it any longer than that, for sure.
Sure.
I would think that as soon as they release Beastgrave and it's legal for tournaments, Shadespire would fall off.
That makes sense. And then the only other caveat is that if there is a card like Hold Objective 1, which is legal in the current one, you can use any printing of that previous. So if you're real attached to your Season 1 Hold Objective 5 card, then then you can hang on to that. So that's those are the facts. Let's get into the questions. I'm going to give you some of the questions. We'll kind of pass it around the horn here, but we'll start it off with one. We had a couple people, William and Kenny, both had a pretty similar question. They're asking, Kenny wanted to know, what cards would you like to see eventually reprinted, and what cards do you hope to never see again? And then William's asking, what cards rotating out would you like to see reprinted? So think about cards that are going away, and give me one or more cards that you hope we'll get to see again, and one or more cards that you are glad to see the tail end of. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. Dean, why don't you take the guest's honors? You got any candidates for this?
Sure. I would like to see Ready for Action never show up ever again.
All right. And yeah, tell me why.
Because it breaks the game. It's a 13th action that you're not guaranteed to get if you don't draw the card. It's not in your top 15 or top 13, whatever it is you see in the game, and you don't have a bag of tricks or something. If you don't see it, you're at a significant disadvantage to your opponent, and it's basically at a 100% play rate. It's just not healthy for the game.
Yeah. And, you know, people like to talk a lot about the luck of particular dice rolls, but this is a card that swings greatly on where you drew it. You know, if you drew it earlier or drew it at all and your opponent didn't, then it's exactly like you're saying. So
right. And the card I'd love to see reprinted on that exact same note is Rebound. Bring it back. Let's bring it back.
Controversial.
It got played 7 times against me at Nova and it didn't go off a single time.
Oh, so you're saying bring it back so you get to keep going against it?
Yeah, it's such a bad card. I've said it's unplayable and you're basically just playing 9 ploys since, you know, it's printed. And everyone else seems to disagree, but I've never once lost to it. Then again, that's probably due to how I play, but it's just not a good card, and I'd love to see people keep wasting slots on it.
All right, sure. And I do think, and I think we'll talk about it more in our we're going to bring you back for the next episode to talk about hold objective play. I think that may be playing into it somewhat, but what's your brother's take on Rebound?
I think he's more down on the fact that just Molog is losing so much stuff that really makes Molog tick.
Yeah.
You know, all of the things that are leaving are just hugely impactful for Molog. So the fact that if Rebound stayed around, that would be worth the cost of losing everything else.
Fair.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Phil, give me one or more of each.
Well, I will just come right back and say that I don't want to see Rebound, but not because I don't like playing against it. I just hate all of the just rage online about the card, and I just don't want to have to listen up to it anymore. So if it was just gone, I would be happy.
Yep.
Yeah, but on a more serious note, a card that I don't want to see come back, Ready for Action for sure. I really didn't like There's actually a lot of cards that, like, just thinking sort of abstractly, I'm like, oh, yeah, those could go. But I think it'd be bad for balancing out other parts of the game. So, like, my initial thought was, like, well, maybe Hidden Paths or something could go because it's this hard thing to balance. Molog with Hidden Paths is super scary and can cause all sorts of havoc and... it's like, let's just get it out of there. But if you take too much of that mobility stuff away, all of a sudden it unbalances the aggro to control dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's maybe not one that should actually go, but I guess it's sort of one that I'm thinking is it was poorly worded and was hard to balance against. And so maybe we just make it go away and we figure out a similar way to do something that's less controversial.
Yeah.
Right. How do you feel about cards that reprinting cards functionally, but with better clarity and just more functional inside the rule set? So like Hidden Paths that didn't count as a move action or something.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. I think we've already seen some of that. I can't think of the exact examples, but I know there's, some stuff that's, you know, it's a similar effect, but they clean up the wording and make it easier to play. And so I'd love to see more stuff like that, where we can take these really confusing cards that had to be errated once or maybe more times to make them make sense and get a similar effect.
Or something like Escalation coming back that only counts objective or upgrades played by a single player, not both, or something like that. Yeah. The way it was probably intended to be.
Yeah,
for sure. And I mean, we could probably, there's probably a whole host of restricted cards that were probably not intended to work the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best example of this is, what's it called? One where you stand on the two sides of the
extreme
board.
Extreme Flank.
Extreme Flank, where it was like, I don't think it ever was intended to work the way that it was written, but they wrote it that way and they were like, oh crap, now what do we do? Like, yeah, that's right. What it says. I guess that's how it works. And so I think they it looks like, you know, based on Dreadfane, and I think we've talked about this before with the Dreadfane review, was that it looks like the wording and the cute, like, you know, just clarity of the rules is something they're cognizant of and are at least making strides to improve. And so we can only hope that if they are going to reprint anything, that it's going to be cleaned up and there'll be less ambiguity.
Sure. I think it's a great opportunity for doing some of that sort of thing. I can't count the number of times that I had to try to explain why Hidden Paths counted as a move, but like not while it was happening, but after the fact it did. Like, you just felt like you were bamboozling somebody who, you know, I'm like, I know this sounds like totally whack and like I'm a big fat cheater, but this is how it's supposed to work.
I mean, in the deck I played, it counts for shortcut, which doesn't count move actions, but it also counts for keep them guessing, is a move action. It's like, I'd explain it twice during the event. It's just like, it's not my thing. This isn't my fault. I promise.
Yeah.
Yep.
For me, I'm sad to see it go, kind of. I wouldn't mind seeing it reprinted as a distraction, as I think a big mover and a shaker there. A lot of interesting things you can do with that. Now it's kind of gone down to, there's a number of factions that have their faction specific version. So I think that's a pretty interesting one. And then for me, one that I'm kind of glad to see the back of is Victory After Victory, and specifically in the context of the score immediately meta. And here it's because, in talking about luck of the draw, when that one falls in the right spot in your score immediately deck, then you end up with these huge scores. I mean, they'll still be available off of, I think it's going to be fairly easy to replace with solid gains and great gains and stuff like that. But I just remember having some games where, like, you know, Allinson walked through a lethal hex and then Draxcuer missed a shot with his crappy little pistol, and they scored, Calculated Risk and Warning Shot, and then got Opening Gambit and Combination Strike and Victory After Victory, and they got 7 glory for doing nothing. And it all came off of, you know, they designed the deck to work that way, but it had to be lucky in the way that the cards came up.
Superior Tactician is a lot like that as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to mulligan it on turn one, otherwise it's fine.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm glad, besides, you know, occasional negative experience, I like that it might pump the brakes a little bit on some of the score immediately and make people look around a little bit. Although, who knows, maybe there's some obvious ones. So we've talked a little already. We kind of covered, David Smee had a question about how, you know, these cards that we didn't want to see them reprinted, how would we like them to change? We already kind of talked about that. Like, the perfect thing is to get some of these interesting cards back, clean up their wording. Or is there a way to take the edge off of a card that is too powerful? His example is, what if Ready for Action came back, but it was the card specifically required you to pick either, you know, like it was a card that only allowed you a move or only allowed you an attack. I think it's maybe still overly powerful in that situation. But there may be some other versions that are like, you know, spend to your glory and do that. You know, there's ways they could make the cost greater
Right. Or the second, if this is the second upgrade attached to that model or whatever.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of ways you could balance it to make it fine, but just the fact that it's one glory to do it, and it's there's really no reaction window that competes with it to stop it is right. also problematic.
Yeah. 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 For its and its cost benefit, that the cost is so low for such a tremendous benefit. So, all right. Next one. This one, Rowan Sweeney asked us exactly how banned do you think Acolyte of the Cataphranes is going to be going forward? I assume we'll see a new banned and restricted at some point here. But on a scale of Great Cunning to Time Trap, Phil, how banned do you think Acolyte of the Cataphranes is going to be going forward?
Absolutely zero chance of it being banned. Yeah. Restricted, maybe. Banned, absolutely not, because they just show that there's going to be a new version of the card coming out with yeah. special art. So if they banned it, absolutely no one would bother to pick it up unless you're Aaron. Because he has problems. But no. So, I mean, like, just from a marketing perspective, you don't print a new card for people to play with and then ban it. You just don't. Right. That's dumb.
It's already restricted, right? So it's like,
it's
so few decks already. Like, what's the point? What are we doing?
Yeah. It's only bad with Molag using it. And even then, you really have to lean into it. And so, I mean, maybe it's still too strong, but I think with so many like strong tools moving out from season one, it may be not even all that bad anymore. Now maybe it brings the power level down for a lot of other warbands as well, so maybe Tome Molag is back on top, but I kind of doubt it.
It's got too many bad matchups. A lot of the passive decks do more passive scoring than the Acolyte deck can do.
Yeah. I mean, and I can say, having run that at ATC, when we were running up against you guys, you gave me the one matchup that I felt good about. I would have felt awful into with Tome's Molag into Aggro Molag, and I would have felt even more awful going into your hold objective Ghosts, I think, because...
Right, exactly.
You could outscore me, and I just didn't have the tech to lay out enough damage, so... I think it's fine, and I think there's a lot of sorting out. Like, we're gonna have a big unstable meta for a while things shake out and people find the new stuff. And of course, I mean, we're all talking about this in the vacuum of not knowing what is actually coming down the line with Beastgrave. So speaking of reprints, Peter wanted to know, why are they reprinting Hold Objective 1? Like the Hold Single Objectives for One Glory. My take on this is it's a good card for a starter set. When you're very first learning the game, it's clear. Yes. It's not overly complicated. You can get, I mean, it feels real bad when you don't get any glory. I can think back to the original starter games where we'd finish a game like 7-3 or something like that. And it was like, woo, 7 glory, man, you guys were on fire.
Yeah. And I mean, it helps introduce the concept of holding objectives without it getting too complicated. So you can sort of learn that part of the game and understand like, oh, this is a thing that I'm going to need to do, without being like, oh man, I've got to figure out how to hold two or three of these at once and get across the board. And like, it's just a scaled back version. And I think that's a good entry point.
The only downside I see is that it likely means that they're not doing anything with objectives for passive scoring, which is something I would have liked to see.
Explain what you mean by passive scoring in this context here.
So similar to how you score glory from getting kills, some way to score glory via the game system for holding objectives, either holding more than your opponent at the end of a turn, getting you a glory, or holding for every two you're holding, get a glory, something like that. Just something that's part of the game.
Oh, which, I see, like built in.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So people have said that with objective, it just invalidates the objectives 1-5, which, I mean, no one was playing anyway, which so it's a really weak argument, but... Yeah. That was really the only argument that I saw against it. So
sure.
And do we know for Beastgrave, are they reprinting them again? Like, has that been confirmed?
I feel like that. image
showed the image, I believe, showed a new art for Objective One or something.
Ah, okay. Yeah, well, it fits the pattern. I don't know. They've set themselves on a sort of, like, this is what the starter box is. And I don't think that's going to change. We're probably going to see Great Fortitude and Great Strength again, too.
Yeah, they have Hold Objective One is shown in the Beastgrave starter there. So, yeah, I think we'll see those. But who knows? They may change things up. So we'll see. But that's why it's there. We'll talk more about it in the next episode. But I do have some hope for Objective Play in the next one. Just there's been some signs from things like focal formation for the Stormcast, which is Rastus and Amos scoring immediately for holding. Each holding an objective at the end of an activation. And then a lot of what Mournflight has got some pretty creative ways to use objectives. We talked about that last episode. So it seems like they've found some ways to experiment with that might be promising for more variations on objective play.
Yep.
So, all right, let's see. Chase on Twitter wanted to know, hey, what is your hidden gem from season 2 that will see more play with the rotation? Dean, I'm going to pitch that to you. Is there a card you think that people have been overlooking that might find the light of day now that some of Season 1's out of the way?
It's going to be hard to say without seeing what is in Beastgrave. Because obviously a lot of cards that didn't make the cut before are going to make the cut now. Like if you were just in this vacuum of just playing Night Vault, there would obviously be a lot of cards that you just couldn't play before because they just weren't good enough. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that was barely good enough before is now a lot better also. So just everything's gotten moved up. So I don't think there's anything that's a hidden gem for me that I think is just going to be like, all right, everyone's going to be playing this card all of a sudden. I don't think there's been that big of a shakeup. But once we see what Beastgrave has, maybe something shows up that no one really thought about before.
Sure. Phil, how about you?
Yeah, I'm sort of in the same boat. I'm just looking through, like, trying to refresh my memory if there's something I was not thinking about, but I don't really think so. That I think the few outlier cards that were really strong were mostly season 1 cards that we were seeing just in every single deck, and I don't know that there's really all that many from season 2 that fit that same mold. I think maybe some things you start seeing more frequently would just be the restricted cards from season 2, just because there's less competition for those slots now. Mm-hmm. So like you might see Fired Up come back in the early parts of Beastgrave because it's an easy score that you now don't have to compete as much against. So, you know, maybe some stuff like that, but I don't think there's anything that really jumps out to me as like, oh man, everybody's going to need to play this because it's so good. And I guess the other thing that I think might see a lot more play now is that you might be able to get away with more magic heavy aggro just because there's less competition in a deck for non-magic things if you're playing a magic heavy like Warband. Mm-hmm. Not that you should necessarily have to lean into magic, but I think it just became more viable, I guess, is the point that I'm
the magic about. Decks are having less competition for those pieces. And we're going to talk about that a little more in a sec. The thing that came to mind, I took a more conservative look at what qualified as a hidden gem, but with, you know, for example, I was thinking with Shade Glass darts and Dark Darts going out the window, there's some warbands that really like to be able to give a ranged weapon to a fighter at the back so they can still do work. Maybe, you know, bump somebody from a long ways away or make sure they get enough charges in or do work even when they're too far away. And so I was thinking that Nullstone Arrow?
Arrow or darts.
Nullstone darts, yeah. And then Seeking Stones are things that people might take a look at from including there. And I would say my other wild card in there was with the Distraction Gone. Sometimes it's real important to get somebody off a spot, like move them in some way. And so I'm wondering if people take another look at Confusion again. I think some decks have been using that to great effect already for a while, but I wonder if it makes its way into a few more. It's so weird because sometimes there's amazing things you can do with it, and sometimes there's just, you know, it's dead in your hand. So that's a that's a tough one.
You play it and you score a shortcut sometimes, and that's it. That's all that happened.
Yeah.
I think that's usually the play.
But I do remember early in season one thinking that it was, I think I would always take sidestep, distraction and confusion just because I liked being able to manipulate the, positioning so much, and there just weren't other options by and large. So, yeah, tough to say. Still on the speculation, line of things, Blake wants us to take a little speculation on what we think the next quote unquote thing in the next card rotation is, i.e. there were relics, there were keys, there were tomes, there were potions. Got a wild guess, and obviously this is just crazy speculation.
Since it's Gur, if I was just going to sort of try and obviously there's not really been any sort of like rhyme or reason for what we've had so far, but like it could be totems or something.
Sure.
With Gur, just because it's sort of that tribal bestial feel, but I mean that's probably not even close, because like tomes have nothing to do with Night Vault. So
yeah, we should see another set of weapons. We saw Shade Glass weapons, we saw Nullstone weapons, so there'd be some kind of weapon. Matthew Martin thinks that there's going to be fancy hats. That's a good enough answer for me.
I mean, I guess there's that, what is it called, the amber something. It's going to be the new sort of substance or whatever hanging out.
That's Gur related. That could do. Sure. All right. We got some questions that kind of revolve around the meta, what we think the fallout's going to be there. So Bob wanted to hear what our thoughts. Is there a play style? And again, it's tough to say, but based on what we know, that a play style that might emerge under a Night Vault dominated meta. And Phil, you've kind of already touched on that, thinking that Magic might kind of come back up. How do you feel about that, Dean?
I think that's exactly what's good. If we're just looking at Night Vault and with no idea what's going to be in Beastgrave, or the status quo stays mostly the same, Magic is just going to be very good right now. Objective play, you really lose just our only way out. You lose two of the hold objective things. You lose all the keys. So that's pretty much not going to be a thing. And aggro loss a lot too. So you're really looking at going back to a lot of do nothing Magic decks, or just do nothing decks in general.
And it'll be interesting.
Speaking my language.
Talking about Beastgrave coming in. Like, if we assume that the box itself holds a lot of stuff that we've seen before, like hold 1 through 5 and great fortitude, great speed, great strength, then it feels like, yeah, the core box is maybe not going to change up too much. On the flip, usually you get the first two warbands pretty quick, right? Like, usually they're out within am I making that up, within 2 to 3 weeks of that first box arriving?
I think it would. That's about right. I think it was it was less than a month, I think, before we saw Eyes of the Nine Zarbags.
Yeah, those two were pretty quick. It might have been just about exactly a month, but it was somewhere in that time range, like 3 to 4 weeks.
Yeah, and I know Sepulchral Guard and Iron Jaws came out pretty quick as well. So, there could be a pretty quick release of new stuff to push whatever thing they may be pushing. A number of people asked us to speculate on specific warbands, so Bob also did, but Benny was asking if we thought there were particular warbands that would get the biggest boost from that from the cut in cards. Conversely, you can talk the biggest cut. Now, Dean, I know you were saying that your brother Duncan was thinking Molag was going to take it pretty hard. Any other thoughts on this one way or the other?
Eyes of the Nine just get so much better.
Nice. Yep. All right.
I'm thinking that's mostly because everyone else is just getting so much worse. So they've got a mage, which is what you want right now, and everyone else is being brought down to your level. So you can play mages with your Acolyte deck, which is pretty much the only build they had anyway. So,
well,
I had something else going, but it's dead now.
All right. I guess I get to see what that is on this weekend, right? Because we're still.
Yeah. See how it goes.
Yep, aggro decks are taking huge hits all across the board. You lose a lot of stuff. So Godsworn takes some hits. But
expound on that a little bit more when you're talking about an aggro deck. What jumps to mind, especially on the hits? Are you ready for action? Is a big one for that extra attack? Yeah,
hidden paths. The aggressive stride or commanding stride or whatever was in leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just losing a lot of mobility. You lose spectral wings, and really you're. As far as mobility goes, you're just down to Faneway Crystal.
Yeah. I felt like Commanding Stride came out. Was that really in leaders?
There was a lot of movement tech in season one.
Commanding Stride was in Molog.
It was in Molog. Yeah. Yep, you're right.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But to your point, Hidden Paths, Spectral Wings, those are a big deal. And this is the funny thing about trying to do this. Like, it's such a big move. Like, I remember sitting there thinking, like, oh, man, like, with Spectral Wings gone... that makes Cover Ground really hard to score. And then I thought about it more, like, you know what makes Cover Ground even harder to score? Cover Ground being cycled out. So
yeah, you just don't even have to worry about it.
Yeah, so there's been a number of those. Phil, boost?
I mean, geez, it pains me to say this, but I think that Cursebreakers just got a huge boost because they were already really good, and now if you restrict a lot of other play styles around them, then it's just like, all right, everybody else has a handicap and they're playing at full strength, so we'll get to enjoy another few months of them just stomping around and being really hard to deal with.
Sure. Especially because they have some options to play passively, and then maybe enough stuff to make the magic happen, and then aggression if needed in as a counterattack. We had similar questions from Hiding Place on Twitter talking about how we feel like season one warbands will be impacted versus season two. David Lee Lancaster had a similar question on Facebook. And I think at the core, if you just look at the raw math, right, all season one goes away, you only have season two. A significant number of those cards are magic related or range related, which is something we're glossing over a little bit more. There's so much more range in season two, and there's a fair number of season one warbands that just can't take advantage of those. So their card pool is cut by more than half, I would say. If you consider they were using. Maybe they had access to half of season two and all of season one. Now they're down to almost half a season of universals they can even apply. I don't think that is necessarily a blanket truth on them, but that's kind of a starting point when you're looking at them.
Yeah, they were barely playable today, and they'll be even less playable once the rotation happens.
Yeah, and I think maybe the thing that I'm saddest about with this initial cycling is that some of the more creative season one builds that we were seeing now towards the end of season two are just dead. You just can't play them at all. The Reavers deck, like a lot of the things you were relying on in there are suddenly just gone.
Ooh, Shardgale, yeah, right.
Yeah, like there's just a lot of it. It's not, Festering, Hungering, Skaven stuff that was relying on a number of things from season one. You might still be able to make that work, it's going to be taking a lot of weapons out, and I don't know how easily those things are to replace. I think the Reavers deck, though, got hit the hardest. Yeah. And I loved seeing Reavers actually win something, and so it's like taking that away, it's just, God, you just twist the knife a little bit there.
Not anymore. It's rotated out. So. this is all with the caveat of not knowing what's in Beast Grave. And so who knows? Like, we're in Gur. Things are savage. Maybe range one stuff is about to get a boost, in which case season one, good on ya, go get them, so it's hard to say. I'm going to roll a couple of these together. There's Chris Spark talks about going back and looking at season one warbands and looking at faction cards, and Kelly Thelselander is talking about looking at what your warband specific cards give you and how that factors in. So, you know, I think the one thing that every warband is going to carry with them going forward is their own warband specific cards. And I think that'll say a lot to like what that warband can do. If they've got strong in faction cards, then they can probably weather the storm better than others, as opposed to other warbands that were looking entirely to universals to do a lot of their things, a lot of their heavy lifting, then they're in perhaps a rougher spot. So
yeah, and if you look at it, the season one warbands have some of the absolute worst faction cards. They were entirely like, it was very much flipped what you'd expect it to be. You'd expect the universal cards to be worse than the faction specific cards, but that wasn't the case in season one.
Mm-hmm.
You basically, everything you were playing was a universal card. Like if you look at the orcs, they have any playable faction specific cards.
Just yeah. Cunning but brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Sepulchral Guard have distraction. But other than that, like...
Yeah.
So, and then when you look at the... Immediately, and as soon as you get to Nightfall, like, the Stormsires and the Queens have some of the best, absolute best faction-specific cards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say those two definitely, I think, have the best in faction cards. And I'm not... And even with Echo... Power Unbound, I think the ones that the at least Cursebreakers got in there are also some of the best ones.
Yep.
So it's sort of this weird, like, let's just keep making these guys better situation. And I think that's part of the reason why they feel like they're still going to be really strong, because they don't need to rely on universals for everything.
And to Kelly's point, I would like to see... universal play be less focused on and have the warbands at least have like in their faction specific cards like a couple different play styles that you're pushing them in the direction of.
Mm-hmm.
But all the cards should be playable, whereas right now it's like three or four cards that are playable at all and the rest of them are just sit in a box somewhere.
Yeah. I think the design team is an interesting spot on this, and you know, logically we could have assumed that there was going to be rotation. We'll talk about that more later, but this puts a lot of weight on those faction specific cards, like making them good enough because that's what that warband is going to carry forward, but don't make them too good because then that warband is too good forever, right? Like that,
yeah.
That's a tricky balance to do. So
yeah. And like, I don't know, I agree that it's not an easy task. I don't envy being the person who has to figure out in a pool of, you know, thousands of cards, how strong this faction's cards need to be playable, but not broken. But at the same time, there appear to be some where it's kind of obvious that this was a bad card. Molog needing
Jabberto to
get four kill. I was more thinking like, oh, I need to get four kills in one turn to score this. And it's like, that's basically annihilation. Like,
yeah.
There's very few warbands where you can get four kills and not have killed everyone.
Right. And then every single faction seems to come with a faction-specific assassinate. We don't need that. It's not necessary. If I want it, I'll play it.
Yeah.
Right. Of course.
Not anymore.
Is there an assassinate now in Season 2?
I don't actually know.
Yeah.
I don't think there is. And so now that maybe makes more sense. But
well, sure. You know, we look and talking about specific, like Dean mentioned, you know, Sepulchral Guard have their own distraction. Before, I mean, double distraction can be pretty awful to play against, especially with certain builds. But it's a bigger deal now that those particular factions still have a distraction equivalent. Like that's kind of a big bump for the factions that do have that. So,
unfortunately, that does not save Sepulchral Guard.
Yeah, they have. We can have an entire episode about the problems with Wave 1 warbands and what makes a competitive warband competitive, but we can pass on that for now.
Sure. Let's see. Well, I think we've got a pretty good chop at that. Let's move on to some... There were some questions surrounding what we feel like the impact on the community is, and Dean, as somebody who's played other competitive games at a high level, I'm going to pitch this first one to you. So what have you been in other game systems that rotated some of their, be it Magic rotated season or something like that? Whether you have or haven't, what's your feeling on the impact of that for the overall health of the game?
As far as the health of the game, it's the only way to do it that makes any sense. If you're going to consistently introduce new cards, you're going to need to rotate out old cards. Doesn't matter what card game or what system you're playing, they all do it, and it makes sense to do it. But that always comes with people complaining about it. Like, someone posted that Magic has done it for years and no one complains about it. It's like, well, I don't think you've talked to Magic players. They always complain about it. Like, it's the number one complaint, but it's the way it is. Like, you have to have that. It has to happen for the health of the game.
Sure.
Otherwise, the only other thing you're going to be doing is just banning the cards instead. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ready for Action, yeah, in my opinion, should have been banned 6-10 months ago. But that's really the only other option going forward. Otherwise, it's just going to be there forever, and that's not okay.
Right. You just talk about the designers having space to design into, and as long as there's these particular pillars that exist, these big cards, it limits where they can design, because, like, oh, well, any card I make that is similar to but not quite as good as that is only going to enter somebody's deck if they want to double down.
Yep.
Or may say, like, well, I can't include this card because it's too abusable by whatever, Ready for Action or, whatever the case may be. If you were to return a card like a better worded Extreme Flank with Hidden Paths out of the mix, all of a sudden, okay, well, like, maybe you really have to work hard to get your two glory on this, something like that with board setups. And so it just opens things up, gives more options for interesting cards and interesting interactions that just isn't possible if you maintain your entire library.
Yep.
I think the other thing that this allows, and you see it with Magic, is that once you have a significant pool of stuff that's been rotated out, you can start experimenting with different formats where certain cards are still allowed, even though normally in the, like, standard sort of competitive format they're not, and it allows you to sort of add wrinkles to deck building that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Yep.
And that really only happens when there's this movement of cards in and out of the available card pool.
It can only be a good thing. At the end of the day, it's going to be a good thing for pretty much every faction. Like, whether you're a casual player or competitive player, there's only going to be upside for this to happen.
Yeah,
Sure.
Have you seen this? Is there I don't know much about Malifaux. Is this something that Malifaux has done, or another game that you've played other than Magic that you're familiar with has done this?
As far as miniatures games, GW games, it doesn't really matter. Like, I've played pretty much all of them, and nothing really gets rotated out. It really just ends up with how things become bad. With GW games, it's just codex creep. They put out a new codex that's usually slightly better than the last codex, and so if you're 6 codexes ago, you're just not playable.
Mm.
So that's the way GW has basically handled it. War Machine and Malifaux, they release a new fact or a new edition, and that's when things change. Or they release errata at some point to kind of keep things from getting broken or unfun. But
yeah,
for the most part, nothing goes away. There's no real rotation that happens.
And I'm passingly familiar with Privateer Press. I had a stint doing some of that. I know they struggle with this as well. There's some system they try to do to bring underused casters, underused models back into the mix.
Yep. They have a testing phase every month or so where they try to, like, boost some underperforming faction or underperforming group of models or what have you. But they also have an issue where they let you play everything they've ever dealt with all at the same time. So you have, like, 6 versions of the same caster or something.
Yeah.
So everyone handles it differently.
Yeah. And so this is kind of a pretty honest and upfront way to say, like, hey, this is the reality. This is what we're going to do. I did want to give a moment, a kind of tip of the hat to Steven here. He did talk about, acknowledging that this can feel invalidating for players who have been playing miniature games are totally unfamiliar with this sort of thing going. And so, like, it's understandable that people are, you know, surprised if it's not something they're used to, or kind of feel bad. And there's going to be a handful of people who got caught in, like, a real bad spot where they just bought up a bunch of Shadespire stuff in time, you know, like, oh, I love this game, just got on, buy up all this stuff. And it's not like the all of that purchase is gone, but it's very different now from what they bought. So
the biggest thing that GW can do to change that conception is to allow people to buy the cards separate from the models.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now you're pinned into buying $30 for cards and just for, you know, whatever universals you're looking for, whether or not you have the warband or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if they had, you know, fix that issue, or like even let you buying cards on demand or something, working with a third party to allow you to do that, that would be a huge help to allow people to build what they want whenever they want without having to worry about buying models with it.
Sure. To the respect of people who might feel hard done by, Eric out of Atlanta was saying, how do we think we're gonna have, well, presumably we are having people quit because of, do we think it's going to be any kind of significant number, or how many do we think? And obviously we're not looking to put like a actual number on, but how big an impact of that do we think will be on our gaming population?
As far as people you see at tournaments, that's not going to change. Nobody who is serious about the game in any significant way is going to leave as a result of this. In fact, everybody I've ever talked to has wanted this to happen. So, but as far as casual people and people on the forums, I'm sure you're going to see some people leave, probably the same number of people that are going to get in anyway. So I'd probably a net even, net zero.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think short term you take a hit. Long term, the game stays healthy, and so long term you probably are better than a net zero, or could be. You know, if the game stays healthy. Otherwise, it gets sick and you ride that bomb all the way down like Slim Pickens. You know, so.
Yeah, I'm always a little confused. So people in the competitive scene are obviously playing this game a lot. They love it. They want to play it at the highest possible level, and they want the game to be as healthy as it can be. So, like you said, Dean, none of those people are going to be upset about this. In fact, I would guess all of them will be very happy about this. I know I am. And the people who generally are more like, you're taking away my stuff, it's like, well, they're not actually physically coming and taking your stuff away. Like, if you want to go to your local shop and play with those cards, the only person who's going to stop you is your opponent. And if they don't want to play with you, then you just need to find someone who's okay with playing a non-competitive game. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And so I think people should also realize that, like, there's not like a Underworld's police that's going to come and force you to not play with those old cards. You just can't play with them in a competitive format. And if you weren't playing in a competitive format to begin with, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, what comes to mind here is, you know, I talked last episode, my brother lives on an island 12 miles off the coast of Maine. He plays with like two or three other people. They play with the same card pool. They're just going to keep doing what they're doing. They're going to keep enjoying what they're enjoying. They're not in danger of going to something. So, yeah, I think we're in agreement here. I get that it feels bad for some folks. I think it's a good thing in the long run. It'll help.
And I think go ahead. I think it'll also help now that the expectation is set. Like, people going into Magic now know that this is a thing that Magic does. You know, every so often sets get rotated out. You know that. With this game, we didn't really know what their plan was. We knew there was this banned and restricted list, but we didn't know if they were going to cycle stuff out or if it was just going to be this continuing pool of banned and restricted cards.
Yeah.
And so now that they've sort of gotten out and said, hey, this is the plan going forward, this is what we're going to do, then it's not this shock of like, hey, here's this stuff that you can't use in competitive. You don't have to buy this stuff. I would guess that that's like this break point, like you rip the Band-Aid off. It's going to hurt a little bit. People are going to be a little upset to begin with. But in the long term, you're like, okay, I'm accepting of this fact now. Going forward, no one's going to get caught unaware.
Sure. And I would say they probably didn't know that they would be heading this way back in season one. They didn't know whether it was going to take off or not. So, you know, cross that bridge when you come to it. We kind of addressed Gary Keenan's question. He was asking do we assume this is done so competitive level events remain accessible? Which is, I guess, another thing we haven't really talked about. Like, this helps for somebody, like, say somebody decides, like, hey, Beast Grave is a great time to jump in. Now they don't have to run back and buy, like you were talking about, Dean, drop $30 on Chosen Axes set so they can have Ready for Action, right? So,
right.
That's another benefit we haven't touched on. He asked if we think Beast Grave will be fully compatible with Shadespire. Sure. I mean, it's the same base. You may have some small tweaks to the rules, but they'll still work together. I mean, they have to because those warbands are still legal, right? So,
yep.
Yeah, you may see things like a new Gambit ploy and Gambit spell or whatever, so your things that only affect ploys don't affect spells for whatever reason. But other than that, like, the games will be compatible.
Yeah. Constantine wanted to know, what did you think about the timing on this? Do you think, because they chose their, and again, we don't know exactly when Beast Grave is going to drop, presumably within the next month. They gave about a month warning on soon as, what did you think about the timing of this? Could it have been different? Should it have been different? What are your take on that, Dean?
I don't think there's a good time to do it. The same people are going to complain the same way no matter when you do it. And this is a good time as any just to say, hey, Beast Grave is coming out. Get excited. The format is going to be very Beast Grave centric rather than being a third Beast Grave. It's going to be a half Beast Grave, at least as far as a numbers standpoint. So I think it's probably the best timing for them. But as far as the community is concerned, there really is no good time.
Sure. I think one of the other things he's getting at is that, do you wait to the end of the year? Because we look at the cards that released at the very end of Night Vault will have had a shorter, or I'm sorry, at the very end of Shadespire will have had a shorter lifespan than the ones that were released at the beginning of Shadespire. But I think it's the right play this way to get a full season, and then so you're going anywhere from one to two complete seasons at any one time. And deck building is going to be harder at the beginning of each season because you're so much more limited. But that's fun. I mean, the challenge is how can I make something functional out of what this is? Like, being challenged in your deck building is one of the appeals of this game, in my opinion.
I definitely agree, and I think this is sort of the point you're getting to. But that if we had two full seasons and then started introducing the third season into it, I think each release would have a smaller and smaller impact for players. They'd say, okay, here's the one, maybe two cards that I'll think about using out of this box, and then I'll just box the rest of it. I don't care. Because I already know that my deck is pretty much set, and I'm only going to add the tools that make it that much better. Whereas if you've just got the one set, that means every single release, there's going to be at least a few cards that have a significant impact on your deck and potentially make you rethink your whole strategy, because it's like, oh man, when I built this deck, I had this limited pool, and now, you know, there's new things I can do that I didn't even think I could do when I was first building this.
Right. So, rather than having five or six slots in your deck just instantly taken up by the five best cards in season one or whatever, like, all right, well, I got to put Ready for Action, Hidden Paths, Escalation, yeah, deck, you know?
Yeah. All right. We got a couple questions that were just kind of more broadly. Oh, actually, let me detour. There was a cool, Cheryl Rychek didn't even ask us a question, but I saw her post in passing. I thought it was a really cool idea. They were talking about, you know, people were talking about, I'm going to throw away all my season one cards. Her suggestion is make a powerful, cool demo deck out of season one cards. When you introduce somebody, you don't have to worry about, oh no, that card is in my demo deck, I can't use it for. You can just leave that deck built, introduce somebody to the game with, you know, it can have whatever, it can have all the restricted in there, give them a nice, real powerful deck so they, you know, whatever, build it, and then they can learn the game, and then you can guide them from there. But
sure.
Other game notes, to the effect of rotation, what do we think about, so Slavic was asking about, rotating boards. You think that's a thing we'll see?
I don't really know how I feel about it, because I don't really think the boards... I think the boards have gotten better with the recent releases, so there's really no advantage to saying you can't play the old boards. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know why they would ever rotate them out, but I could see them rotating it out just to be consistent.
And I don't think there's enough boards yet for it to feel right. So say we took everything from Season 1 out. Well, that's 4 boards. We only have 8. Like, if you took out 4, you're then in tournaments when you can't use the same board twice.
I think it's 8, or there's 6, right? There's only 6 boards?
Well, but...
2-2-1-1. Yeah, 6, right?
6?
Yeah, we got 6 with 2 sides each. So you got 12 board sides that you're operating 12, with right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so it wouldn't be quite as impactful as I was thinking, but still, you know, you take out that much, and suddenly your choices are pretty limited in a tournament because you can't use the same one twice, and I don't think the pool is big enough that you don't want to be pigeonholing people on their board choice, unless they just took out that rule for tournaments, but then you'd just get people playing the same board every single time because it's the best one for their, like...
No, I don't think they'll go back on that. That was a cool...
Yeah, I think it's a good choice, but you need a decent pool to work from if you're going to do that.
Sure. Now, Beastgrave will jump us up to 16, so... because we're presumably getting 2 boards with... 2 sides each, so we'll have 16 board sides to operate off of. So I'm not sure either way. And I think to Dean's point, some of the Season 1 boards, some of them I think are usable in certain circumstances, and some of them, you know, the later ones are a little more exciting. So either way they go, I don't think it'll be a disaster. And the last one, Blake was asking... this is kind of off topic here, but asking what we think about going on guard if the Dreadfane rule comes forward. It's the one where you can't get driven back if you're on guard. I think Phil and I talked about liking that little tweak. His concern is that it's more passive. You know, we really want people just standing around, not attacking and just hoping to not get hit. Go ahead.
Yeah, for my playstyle, I think it'd be huge. It'd be hugely helpful for the holding objectives playstyle, especially since I play 2 different ploys that put models on guard.
Yeah.
And if I couldn't be driven back, because I know a lot of people just, you know, charge in, take a shot, drive you back, even if that's on a tie or whatever, and then you don't score so much. It'd be huge for objective holding, which I do think, in general, needs a buff across the board.
Agreed.
Just if you look at the number of cards that even mention objectives in the first 2 seasons, it's like not even 10% or whatever of the total card pool, which is weird for a game that has an entire phase dedicated to putting them down, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do think I like that change, but I'm biased, obviously, because it's hugely, hugely impactful to how I play.
So, yeah, and I think anything that's giving people more meaningful options is good. I think you basically only saw guard, as we've said. You mostly saw guard to set up change of tactics or to set up keep them guessing with a couple other. I would, you know, on rare occasions where I've got somebody on 3 defense dice or something like that, then you get a big boost out of putting them on guard. And then inevitably the person across from you has cleave, but whatever. Jason Murray asked about the broadest question of all, so we're going to let him take us out. He was, what are you most looking forward to, what the rotation will bring? And he basically asked in broad terms most of the questions that we've already kind of covered. But Dean, give me your summary and I think people have a good sense now from each of us, but your overall feeling on the idea of this rotation.
The most exciting thing on the rotation is Beastgrave becoming legal and starting to build decks. That's always the most exciting thing for me when a new set comes out. I was just looking at the new cards and building new decks with, you know, half the cards leaving. It's going to be a open season for building decks leading up to the boys in November.
Yeah. Phil?
Yeah, in a similar vein, just what I'm hoping will be some new play styles that we can see come out. I think there was a number of different things that we saw in the later half of Night Vault that we probably never would have even thought of in Shadespire. And I'm hoping that this rotation has a similar effect and that it just forces people to look at the game from a different perspective. Just some variety in the game, I think, is always what I'm looking for. And this is going to be a good way to make sure that happens.
Yeah. I think for me, I've said before, I think the game is at its most exciting and perhaps healthiest when the meta is in flux and nobody's sure what is good and what the ideal builds are. And that's exactly what this sort of thing does. Everybody's going to be trying to come up with the new hotness between the cut and between the new stuff from Beastgrave. And I love seeing what people can innovate and come up with. And that's an exciting time to be in it. So I think that's going to do it for us. You guys got anything else you want to pitch in before we wrap this one up?
No, I don't think so.
We will get out of here. As always, you can get in touch with us at WTHcast and whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Dean, I'll throw you on the spot real quick. Do you want people to be able to get in touch with you? And if so, how would they do that?
No, I'd like to lurk. Okay. Keep my lurk stats intact.
Very well. For thanks, I just want to say thanks to all the people who put in questions. I was surprised by how many questions we got, and that was cool. Everybody, Twitter and Facebook and all that. I should give a shout out to Dogs of Warcry. If you like skirmish games, the Warcry is the latest. There's another cast on our network, Dogs of Warcry. They've just released their second episode. You can go check them out. They're existing on the main Mortal Realms feed, and they also have their own. They'll be switching to their own at the third episode. So if you've been listening on the main feed, get over onto their individual one. As always, drop us a review. We really appreciate it. And your recommended listening for this episode is Seasons by Chris Cornell. That's off the singles soundtrack. For What the Hex, I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
And this is Dean.
Yeah, a couple of professionals here. I don't know if you saw. So our episode 19 and 20, I had like this weird background. I sound like scratching on paper or something like that. Every time I was like, it was clearly on my end when I'm editing, and I'm like, it's driving me crazy. And I was like, what the hell? I got this mic set up, and I got like a pop filter. What could it be? And it turned out that when I would change the settings, I wouldn't close the settings tab, so it wouldn't save them. So I recorded both those episodes using the microphone in my headphones cable, and the scratching was it rubbing against my shirt. So
sweet.
You know you're a professional when you get the cool gear and then don't use it properly.